I do think it's important to mention that in Australia, this movie is pronounced Nar.
What?
Like, Nar. You know what I'm talking about?
What are you talking
When
about?
they say no, it's like pronounced Nar.
My
So
God.
saying it's Nar.
For any of our Australian listeners.
Offense intended. Offense intended. The battalions are up. Let's see what you got.
Hello, and welcome to A Century in Cinema. My name is Arthur. I'm a local filmmaker here in Utah, and we're in the year 2014. I went to go see Godzilla like a dozen times in theaters.
Is this why you don't like Three Colors? Because Juliette Binoche doesn't die off in the first 5 minutes?
Oh, that makes sense.
There we go. All right. And my name is Andrew. I am a professional film historian. And I don't insert joke here about animals walking two by two into my anus.
Oh, God.
Is that bad?
No, it sets expectations for the episode.
I guess so. I don't know. Now I'm nervous. What's this episode going to be?
Not family friendly.
Oh, that's fair. Yeah. I mean, the show isn't family friendly.
And this is a podcast where we watch and discuss a classic film that I have not seen
But I most likely have.
from every year. This week we are in 2014. We're watching Noah, directed by Darren Aronofsky. For any new listeners, you can always find where our movies are streaming or available to rent online down in the link in our show notes. I rented this one from Amazon Prime.
I did as well, yeah.
Well, what's going on in the year 2014 in the world? Just giving us a little context before we move into some film history. In Western Africa, there is an Ebola virus epidemic going on. Aid is being sent in from all over the world. Luckily, the epidemic is contained. The war against the Islamic State is going on. I mentioned last year that I believe they were rising to power in 2013, and now there is active conflict against ISIS. Do you remember how there were random things in America named ISIS? There was like a cell phone company. I remember seeing their billboards, ISIS.
Yes.
I remember on the TV show Archer, their company that where they worked was called
That's what I
ISIS.
was gonna say.
What are you going to do? Sometimes a terrorist group co-opts a perfectly fine name. 2014 is also when we have the Scottish independence referendum. I believe this fails. Definitely fails. And Andrew, do you know what happened to Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 when it was flying over the Indian Ocean?
Why does that ring a bell?
Well, it's because no one knows what happened to it. It just disappeared. We don't know.
Jeez.
Also, Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 is shot down over eastern Ukraine. Jeez, Malaysian Airlines not having a great year in 2014. The airline is shot down because of conflict going on between Ukraine and Russia. And this is also the year that Crimea is annexed by Russia, which has taken on new significance in the year 2022. What do we want to talk about at the top of the box office?
Oh, I don't know. What is at the top of the box office?
Worldwide box office, what's at the top? Ugh. Transformers, Age of Extinction, $1.1
I
billion.
didn't see that one.
I know you didn't see number two, The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies.
I know you didn't either.
That one didn't even break a billion, probably because we didn't go see it.
We were what was holding it back.
Truly. Number three, Guardians of the Galaxy, all the way down at 770 million. You know, I noticed in the past couple of years, we've had a lot of films, a lot is relative, a lot of films breaking the 1 billion mark. It feels like 2014 is kind of a quieter year, so to speak.
Yeah, I remember there was no Pixar movie this year.
Yeah, I see some Disney films, Big Hero 6, Rio 2. That's not Disney. How to Train Your Dragon 2. But then there's also the Lego movie, which I really love.
I don't love it, but I have a lot of respect for it, and I think the animation is incredible in it.
And as I mentioned, the American Godzilla comes out. That's my obscure recommendation for the
Oh, that's a good one. Did X-Men Days of Future Past do any numbers at all?
Yeah, it's at number six.
And that's like probably the last good X-Men movie we'll ever see.
Wait. Doesn't everyone love Logan?
I liked it, I guess. Did that come out later?
Yeah.
But it's not like an X-Men movie.
It's a Logan movie.
It's a same director and creative team as the Wolverine.
Mm.
But I feel like as far as a big ensemble X-Men movie, however specific I need to get, I think Day of the Future Past might be the last good one we ever see.
Fair enough. I am not going to refute that, yeah.
Should we do some recommendations from this year?
Yeah, you got God's Not Dead in there somewhere?
I don't. I've never seen it. Otherwise, it might make the list. It's on the watch. It's on the watch list.
Mm, okay. Okay.
It's like fully the Avatar franchise of Christian straight-to-DVD movies. Anyways, I do have a fairly religious film on my recommendations for this year. In 2014, the year of our Lord. Then I'll recommend that one now. It's called Calvary, directed by John Michael McDonagh, who is Martin McDonagh's brother. This is a gorgeous film about an Irish priest who has... he's battled a lot of demons throughout his life, including an ongoing struggle with his son, who is currently in a mental facility. And the lead performance by Brendan Gleeson as the priest is just incredible. The script is so well written and so tight. It's a very short film, gorgeously shot. It really does a great job of visualizing his isolation from the world around him that is starting to grow and evolve away from his beliefs. It's a really great movie, Calvary, by John Michael McDonagh. Highly recommend.
Mm.
Next up, I'm going to recommend The Tribe.
Oh, yes.
By, oh, God, Miroslav Slaboshpitsky.
Perfect.
Have you seen this?
I have seen this. Yeah, I saw this at Sundance.
Oh, same. Did you see it at the Tower?
I don't remember.
I was at the Tower and people were walking out.
Yeah, I remember people walking out.
So this is a Ukrainian, I think. The entire film is in sign language and there's no subtitles at all. And the film is using the character's sign language as a way of it's showing how universal the communication itself is, because it's a pretty dense plot that's being told only through this way of communication. It's very engrossing and investing. It's impossible not to be a little bit on the edge of your seat. The entire film is only 33 shots, very, very long takes shots that all tell the story of this young boy who has joined a school for the deaf and dumb, and the bullies he encounters, the drug culture he encounters, the prostitution ring he encounters.
Oh, no.
Turns out things aren't great in this school.
It's not good.
And it has a really terrifying, horrible ending that takes the character's deafness into account in a very scary way. I do recommend The Tribe, though. It has a lot to say about modern politics, modern society, and it's a tough-to-watch film, but I think it's a very important film, and I think it's probably my favorite movie of this year. I really love The Tribe.
And it is a Ukrainian film.
Next up, I'm going to recommend Clouds of Sils Maria, directed by Olivier Assayas. This is a sort of a postmodern take on Fassbender's The Bitter Tears of Petra von Kant, where in this universe, The Bitter Tears of Petra von Kant is a stage play that Juliette Binoche played the young woman who was seduced by the older Petra von Kant when she was younger. And now that she's an older actress, she's being asked to be in the revival of the play and to play the older seductress now. And a potential Chloe Grace Moretz is supposed to play the younger girl that Juliette Binoche had played when she was younger. She's also joined by her personal assistant, played by Kristen Stewart. And the film is mostly a series of conversations between different characters about the state of Hollywood, about actresses and the way they age and the way they're viewed by the world as they age. It also features an insane meta sequence where Juliette Binoche and Kristen Stewart go to see the newest big blockbuster film that Chloe Grace Moretz is in. And Kristen Stewart's character defends Chloe Grace Moretz's performance in the blockbuster movie, but she is very obviously defending her own performance in Twilight through this film. The ending gets me choked up every time. I like The Clouds of Sils Maria a lot. You seen that one?
No.
I think you'd like it.
Yeah, it sounds good.
And finally, this movie was more of an experience than an actually great movie. I'm not necessarily telling anyone to go out and rent this movie and watch it tonight, because I don't even know if it would make any sense or be good. The film I want to recommend, lastly, is Goodbye to Language, directed by Jean-Luc Godard, which I had the pleasure of seeing in 3D. And similar to most of Godard's later works, this movie isn't a narrative. It's sort of an essay mixed of visual essay and a conversation between Godard and the film itself. It's a little impossible to decipher, very esoteric. But the cool thing about this movie is that it was all in 3D, but it was all using different cameras. There were no 3D cameras. What he did was he would set up, say, two iPhones or two TIs, and he would have them angled against each other perfectly to be able to create two images that, when projected correctly, would be as if it was shot on a 3D camera. And the effect was very good. And the coolest part about this movie is that the 3D isn't used just to create depth to the image. It is also used in a way that I've never witnessed in any other film, which is to split scenes into two different places. So you're watching one shot that's in 3D, and then a character will leave the image, but on one side, the image is still there. So if you close one eye, you're looking at the other person who's still sitting down and reacting. If you close your other eye, you're following the other shot that's following the person who's walking around. If you keep both eyes open, it's just like a mess. It's an experiment in cinema that I think is very successful. If you ever get a chance to see this in 3D, I can't recommend it enough. You might not even necessarily enjoy it, but there's no denying the technique here is astounding. And it feels like someone who is cynically trying to express a loss for cinematic language is at the same time creating a brand new way to use cinematic language. So even through his own cynicism, he has created hope for the future of his favorite art form. And I think there's a lot of beauty in that. R.I.P. Godard. You were an asshole, but I loved you.
I want to recommend A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, which I think we recommended in our Persepolis episode, but it's worth restating here. This is an Iranian film, black and white, micro budget, about a vampire. It's a vampire story. Yeah, it's a great little movie. I really recommend it, if that sounds interesting to you.
Paddington also came out this year. Do you like Paddington?
I do like Paddington. Paddington's very charming. And it's got Sally Hawkins, who, I gotta say it, is great in Godzilla. She's fantastic. I'm sorry, I will stop, but I do like that film. Actually, Andrew, I have a question for you. Did you watch The Interview?
No, I actually haven't seen that movie.
Oh, I have seen it. I don't remember it. So there you go.
But they didn't actually interview him at the end.
They kill him at the end.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. Brutally. Graphically. I can see why the North Korean government was upset with this film. I guess I'm trying to remember. Maybe this is the first case of a big Hollywood film being released online exclusively, which is now sort of normal.
It wasn't released in theaters at all?
No.
Because of the whole thing?
Because of the whole thing. Basically, the North Korean government held the film hostage, threatened violence on theaters, et cetera, and Sony just pulled the film, didn't show it in any theaters, and then, as sort of a fuck you to the North Korean government, just released it online.
Hmm.
What is our film for the week?
This week we are discussing Noah. You got the plot this week?
Yeah. And the Lord said unto Noah, come thou and all thy house into the ark, for thee have I seen righteous before me in this generation. It's basically the story. As you can tell, I did not write this up, but I got this. I got this.
I'm just floundering. What is that from?
The King James Bible.
Yes, I know.
Which I keep by my podcasting setup at all times, just in case I need a little support.
He's praying for me. He really wants me to be saved. That has been the underlying intention of this entire project.
Just keeping Andrew out of trouble. No, this is the story of Noah's Ark. You all know it. A long time ago, God realizes that his creation, human beings, have gone bad. And he decides to kill them all in a worldwide flood, with the exception of Noah and his family, who are the only good people left on Earth. God's also going to kill quite a bit of the animals, except for two of each species, which are sent to Noah and his family, and they are housed in a giant ark that lets them survive the worldwide flood. It rains quite a bit. Everyone dies. Noah and his family survive. The animals survive. They repopulate the earth. Noah and his family repopulate the earth. God promises never to do this again, sends them a rainbow. All is well. But there are some differences here in the film.
Would you say some notable differences?
A handful of notable differences in the movie adaptation. There are fallen angels slash rock monsters who help Noah and his family build the ark. There is a villain character, a king of basically just an unruly mob who wants to take the ark and actually stows aboard the ark and becomes like this antagonist for some of the film, and wrestles with Noah at the end in a big fight scene. It's very dramatic. Oh, he also killed Noah's father at the beginning of the film, so he's a bad guy.
Well, and he is mentioned in some texts to Balkane.
And the rock monsters are mentioned in some texts as Nephilim, fallen angels.
Yeah, I think that these angels and their names specifically come from the Book of Enoch, which has been essentially cast out as part of the official Bible because of struggles with its interpretations, translations, and dating the text.
We don't want anything unrealistic slipping in there. But the big character change between, you know, the real life Noah and the movie adaptation of Noah is that in his visions of the end of the world, he interprets these messages from God to mean that the animals are to be saved, but mankind itself is to die out. He and his family will be the last people on Earth, but they are to basically bury themselves, basically just wither away, and the world is to go on without people. So when Emma Watson becomes pregnant on the ark, oh no, Noah promises to kill her baby if it's a girl. Not if it's a boy, but if it's a girl, he's gonna murder the baby. So we got our main character promising to murder a baby and then almost doing so. It's a great film.
You felt that way?
I actually don't know exactly how I feel about this. This film is crazy, though. This is nuts.
Wild. A wild ride.
I can't believe they let this happen. That's kind of my big takeaway. I can't believe Paramount just kind of let a lot of this happen. There's some sequences in here that are really alienating to what I would think is a core audience for the Genesis story of Noah's Ark. But they're in here and they're great. The creation scene is what I'm talking about specifically. And it's
one of the best things Aronofsky's ever put on film. Absolutely.
Oh, it is. It shows the creation of the earth, the evolution of animals into humans, but it's narrated with the Genesis story. So it's a very poetic interpretation.
I think that it is trying to meet something in the middle, right? Because we see the evolution into apes. But then when humans are introduced, they are like sort of these different beings. They're like these glowing beings.
Something special, yeah.
Yeah. So, but yeah, it absolutely is a pro-evolution. And that, yeah, that sequence of showing evolutionary, because it's all done with just quick photos that are being shown in rapid succession.
Fantastic time lapse, yeah.
But there's like a motion that's constant through the photos, so it isn't too discombobulating from the image, and it's entrancing and beautiful.
I thought it was beautiful, and Russell Crowe's
narration,
right, I thought was really well done. That is also the scene where he basically tells his family what's going on in his head, how he basically just wants to let humanity die off, and they're kind of like, what, holy shit, what? Started off as like a nice little bedtime story, but it's kind of traumatizing by the end, isn't it?
Yeah, I love that scene. He turns to his sons and says, okay, this is the order we're going to die in, and you're going to be the very last human. And he's telling that bit about being the last human to, like, a 9-year-old child, which is a tough burden to bear.
What do you think of this movie?
I really enjoy it. I actually thoroughly enjoyed it on this revisit.
Nice.
But I remember when I first saw this film, it didn't do much for me. Visually, I thought it was pretty stunning, but I wasn't completely enraptured with it, and also found it a little preachy at times. Then when Mother came out, because Aronofsky always releases his films in twos, they always sort of complement each other. And when Mother came out, which was the obvious complement to this film, which is his telling of the entire history of the world, starting with biblical stories, all in the framework of a house horror movie, I loved that movie so much, and that movie moved me so deeply that it felt like it contextualized Noah better for me, and I started speaking better of Noah after watching Mother. But I actually have never revisited Noah since seeing it in theaters. So this was my first time watching it since then, and I've got to say, I just really think this is remarkable stuff. I think this is a really well-done film. It shows this brutal history of the world, and it takes this story that feels so familiar and makes it feel very fresh on screen. It does this great job of having realistic imagery, and then it adds in these fantastical elements that shows the era of a world gone by, something, you know, that we can't access anymore. I do think religion is interesting. I'm a lot softer on it now in discussions than I used to be, because it used to be such a source of trauma for me, and now I'm more of like a skeptic who's interested. I doubt I'll ever be, you know, a quote-unquote believer again in my life, but I do find these stories really interesting, and I, you know, at the end of the day, we don't really know about the origins of humanity. It's we have a lot of science to back things up, and even the science seems to stop at a certain point, and it's like, this is where things get a little dodgy. And then we have all this religious text that all reads as completely ridiculous, but if you put yourself in the mindset of someone living at this time period, they could be describing common phenomena that was just so uncommon at the time that there was no other way to describe it but to make this fantastical statement about it. And I find that really interesting as well. And I like this movie for saying, no, the magic is real. Like, there were these people who lived forever and they had these powers and there were these angels on Earth. I don't know. There's something really fascinating about it to me. But I was very entertained visually. I still think this movie is just stunning to watch. And I enjoyed it quite a bit. What'd you think?
Like I said, I think it's nuts. I enjoyed it. And I've wanted to see it ever since it came out, honestly. I like Darren Aronofsky as a filmmaker. I don't know why I just never checked this one out. But I think I like him because a lot of his films are smaller scale, very human stories. They're psychological, horrifying films. And this always just struck me as, this movie that was co-opted to become a biblical epic, this big CGI extravaganza. And it just didn't interest me after I saw the trailers. I'm like, I don't know if that's really talking about what I care about when I think of an Aronofsky film. Having seen it now, again, it's nuts. Our main character for the last half of the film is intent on killing babies. It's crazy. It definitely delves into the stuff I love about Darren Aronofsky's work. It is psychological and it is horrifying, and God never actually speaks to Noah. It's all these weird cryptic visions that he's left to interpret, and they kind of drive him mad. I love that. I love a lot of the liberties this takes with, you know, the four paragraphs from Genesis. I really like the interpretation and the reimagining of things, like how this is kind of like a sci-fi fantasy world. Like, all the animals look just a little off, right?
Yes.
It's really cool. And how it's like a post-apocalyptic industrial civilization. And when we zoom out and we see the entire world has been covered in cities, and the world doesn't look right. It's like the oceans are a different shape than what they are and what we're used to.
It's like a Pangea.
I dig that kind of stuff. Yeah. And I'll be honest with you, I'm also just really interested in the story of Noah's Ark and the flood myths from around the world. And that's so fascinating to me that you have not only the biblical story that we in the West are very, very familiar with, but you can go on Wikipedia and see a whole list of flood myths from every culture. And some of them are really, really close to the biblical one in a really weird, creepy sort of way. That's interesting to think about. And some of them are nuts, too. Like, I think there's a Norse myth where people fight a giant and they stab it and it bleeds all over the world. The world is drowned in this giant's blood. And the people who survive climb to the top of a mountain, this family that's sort of like Noah's family. But then you also have like the Thai flood myth, where basically Noah and his family survive the great flood by taking all the animals into a giant gourd like a pumpkin, where they float around for a little while before coming to rest and repopulating the world. So this is clearly a myth and a story that is universal to the human experience. That's just fascinating. I want to think about that some more.
Same. I like thinking about it a lot. And also, just for people who are keeping score, we haven't done a big tentpole blockbuster since Batman 1989. We've done some bigger Hollywood fare, but we haven't done like a big, this is our movie for the season, and it cost us hundreds of millions of dollars. We haven't done that since Batman.
And this was a $160 million film that Paramount just let happen. It feels like a director's statement. It doesn't feel like there's any studio interference.
Well, there actually was quite a bit, and it all went to the garbage.
So Darren Aronofsky won out?
Yes. So, and he won out as fair and square as it can be in the Hollywood game. It was fair and square. He was fighting them so much over his final cut of the movie, and they were terrified of it because they didn't think it would reach Christian audiences and that people would reject it. So they did all these studio mandated cuts and all these things, and they played the movie for religious audiences, and all of them complained, and all of the complaints had to do with the scenes they added and the scenes they changed. They went through, I think, 3 different cuts of the films with test screenings. Oh. And then after the third one was just another disaster, they just had to concede, okay. Like the way Aronofsky says it is, and they eventually decided to use the version that I had created, which is the one we'd agreed upon, and the script that they greenlit. That's how he describes it. It's like, this is what they wanted, and this is what they said was good, and then they tried to change it, and then when they realized they couldn't in a satisfactory way, they decided to go with my final cut instead.
Wow, cool. Yeah, this was a $160 million film by some metrics, and the worldwide box office is stated here on Wikipedia as being about $360 million. So, honestly, seems good.
Yeah, his highest grossing film. This is what got him the blank check to do Mother. And it was the highest grossing opening weekend for a Russell Crowe film.
Didn't expect that either. And I'll be honest, I chose this film partly because I wanted to see it, but also because I am fascinated with exploring these big Hollywood tentpole films that fail. In my mind, Noah was a disaster. I seem to have some sort of Berenstain Bears, like, different reality in my mind where everyone agreed that this was bad. It lost a ton of money, et cetera, et cetera.
I do think there are a lot of people who think this is a bad movie. I mean, it didn't please a whole lot of people. And now, especially in retrospect, it feels like it had little impact on major culture, but it was a huge financial success.
Yeah, little impact on culture. I can see that.
But, you know, we're only 8 years out. We don't know.
Mm-hmm. I sent you a little video.
Yes, Mark Kermode talking about the Pope.
Mark Kermode saying that the most important film critic in the world, at least for Noah, is the Pope. And this is a great little video that details the troubled story of the Noah production courting the Pope's approval for this film in order to win over religious audiences, which I thought was, I don't know, just a fascinating story. And of course, something you would want to do for a film like this. Again, I watched Noah and I said, who the hell is this film for? It does not feel like it is pandering to religious audiences at all, which is bold. I love that. But I can understand how Paramount would be like, oh my God, we got to pander to the religious audiences. And Kermode is specifically talking about the history of this happening with the Passion of the Christ and how the previous Pope allegedly said that Passion of the Christ is as it was after he saw the film.
What does that mean?
Means that it's a documentary for all intents and purposes. It is as it was, Andrew.
Oh.
And Noah also apparently is as it was. Although the Pope did not say that, according to a tweet from Russell Crowe, Russell Crowe's all like, hey, thanks, Mr. Pope, for the blessing. Means a lot. I actually don't know how this story ends.
It ends with the movie making $300 million and some religious people thinking it's great. I feel like there's a space for like Seventh-day Adventists in this, where there's this attempt to breach science with religion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, there are some religious groups that are more eager to lean into something like that. And I think those people were very pleased with this. And I think that people who are very devout to the Bible as it's written were like, what the hell? This is not the story. And I think people who were unfamiliar with the Book of Enoch and were unfamiliar with exterior details given about the life of Methuselah and other people in Noah's lineage were like, did they just make all of this stuff up? But I mean, with you and me, we were never going to care about that.
No. I mean, to me, it's just fascinating. I mean, you could have told this story in a very straightforward way, and you actually sent me a video that does a very straightforward adaptation of the Noah's Ark story from Fantasia 2000. I do love that little film, but it's so short, you know, it's like 7 minutes. How else are you going to expand four paragraphs in the Book of Genesis? I gotta say, I like the liberties taken with Noah. They are bonkers, but I think they make for a pretty engaging film.
I would agree.
It's not like any other $160 million film I can remember.
Yes, I like that the vibe seems to be let Aronofsky do whatever he wants. And I'm always interested. I'm always entertained, too. Never been bored during an Aronofsky movie.
No. Are they comedies? I think that some of them are comedies. Some of them are funny.
I think Black Swan is camp and is very comedic for me. Mother is not for me. I wouldn't say Noah was for me at all.
There's some hamminess in Noah.
Oh, because the son's name is Ham?
That's right. We got Ham all over the screen sometimes.
Where's my gin?
You know, I know he got his start with Pi, and I don't think I've seen Pi.
I haven't seen Pi.
According to Letterboxd, I have seen it, though.
I love that.
But the films from him that I absolutely love, The Fountain, starring Hugh Jackman.
And I think there are a lot of reflections of that movie in this one.
Mm-hmm. There's definitely a religious tone in The Fountain that I see reflected here. I remember just loving the look of The Fountain, especially the scenes in space with that weird spaceship bubble and the tree and everything. I mean, it's just, it's iconic. It's great.
Absolutely. I love The Wrestler. I think The Wrestler and Black Swan are both sort of 10 out of 10s for me.
Yeah, I think The Wrestler is probably his, it's definitely his most approachable film for a lot of people. That's just a great drama.
But it's still so depressing and dark.
It's brutal.
It is a horrible movie for your emotions, that is for sure. It feels like you've just taken the beating of your life after watching that movie. I think that's why I like Black Swan so much, is because it gives me that sort of feeling, but then also gives me some space to laugh and think some of it's a little silly. But then when things need to get very serious, they get very serious. And I like that.
Also a filmmaker clearly influenced by one of our favorite film directors from Japan, Satoshi Kon.
Yes, they were very close friends.
Oh, I didn't know they were friends. That's awesome.
Yeah, Darren Aronofsky paid Satoshi Kon a bunch of money, allegedly. This story is so flip-flopped all over the globe and through culture, and we don't really have a lot of details.
Might be flim-flam.
Yes, but allegedly Aronofsky paid for the filming rights to Perfect Blue to Satoshi Kon just so he could lift imagery from it in Black Swan and Requiem for a Dream. This happened a long time ago. And a lot of people have accused him of ripping off images from Perfect Blue in his films, but it doesn't seem like there was ever any animosity between them. They, for all intents and purposes, it seems like they were actually pretty good friends.
Cool.
Which I think is great.
Now, even though Aronofsky got his start with the micro-budget film Pi, I don't think he was necessarily on people's radar until, well, a lot of people's radar, until Requiem for a Dream in 2000. That's the film I remember everyone recommending. I gotta watch this. And of course, you heard the soundtrack everywhere. It was used in trailer music, like, throughout the 2000s.
Yeah, and it's a nightmare. Horrifying nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
That one's really tough to watch.
His films aren't pleasant. They can be fun, but I was going to say they're hard to get through sometimes.
This, I actually think Noah is one of his easier films to watch. I think it's his only PG-13 movie, and there's not like a whole lot of blood and violence. There are a couple of pretty grisly deaths, but nothing as graphic as what happens in his other movies.
No, a lot of the graphic imagery is implied.
You know what my favorite shot in this movie is. You should just take a guess.
Take a guess. Is it the extraordinary shot of people clinging to the precipice of a mountain?
Yes.
As the floodwaters rise and waves batter their bodies?
Yes.
And off in the distance, we see Noah's Ark just floating by.
It looks like a painting. It's such a horrible graphic image. It really sticks with you. It really just sort of sinks its claws into you. The movie in general doesn't shy away from just how horrifying a flood throughout the world would actually be to civilization. But that shot is the moment where the film dives all the way into the horror of it.
Yeah, and we cut to that shot from inside the Ark when Noah's family can hear everyone's screams outside. They don't have that in Fantasia 2000.
No, they cut that part.
Maybe wisely, for that adaptation. Just didn't fit the tone of the Donald Duck stuff.
But one of the reasons I found revisiting that so interesting is because this is sort of like a kid's story now, you know? Like, from the Bible, this is seen as sort of a children's tale.
Oh, yeah.
But so even from a very young age, I always thought, wait, but everybody died. Everybody died.
They were all bad.
That was so horrible to imagine. And I like that this movie exists to show that part of it, because the majority of the film is this sort of analysis of different people's emotions having to wrestle with this internal guilt of realizing they are on a mission, whether it is for a higher being or not, that is going to save them and the rest of the world will perish.
Mm-hmm.
And the majority of the film happens after the flood within the Ark itself and sort of this intermingling character drama in the boat.
Which is all great stuff.
It's something to think about. You know, if Noah's Ark was a real thing that happened, it would probably feel way more like this. People inside of an Ark saying, why can't we save more? What are we going to do? What is the plan? How do we know when we're going to hit land? When will this be over? Are we just going to die right now? And I think Russell Crowe does a great job of delivering this performance where you can tell he personally is on this mission, but you can also very easily see how from the outside it's hard to tell whether he is actually a prophet or if he is some sort of crazy man. He just seems crazy through a lot of the movie. He seems completely batshit.
I don't know if he knows either. You know, that's part of the great drama in this film is if he's interpreting these visions correctly and what he needs to do and all this stuff. I thought it was great.
Yes, I thought he was wonderful.
Jennifer Connelly does a great job balancing out his madness, though, because for the last half of the film, I mean, I was not on his side. He had become the villain. I mean, he is the villain. He's stalking Emma Watson and threatening to kill her babies. And it's horrifying. So I appreciated having Jennifer Connelly become sort of the matriarch figure that I could follow to lead the family on. I don't know any of their names. I'm sorry.
That's okay. It's like, I know Emma Watson is Ela, and then there's Jabeth, Ham, and whoever the older son is. Shem, that's right.
And what's his wife's name?
Oh, Name.
There you go.
What if we were in an ark? Do you think you could follow through on a plan like this?
I don't think so, man.
Yeah, I think I would just start eating the meat and chilling. Be like, if a flood comes, whatever, take me.
You just start eating the animals, huh?
Yeah.
This film doesn't want you to eat those animals, man.
Is Aronofsky himself a vegetarian? I'm Googling this now. I'm sure he is.
He better be, because evil people in this film are eating meat. They're just biting off animals' heads, doing whatever they want. Whereas Noah and his family appear to be vegan, vegetarian. They're never seen eating any meat. It's probably one of the more defining attributes of the mob of people, of the wicked people of the world. You know, they're hunting animals. They're eating meat.
There's this really great sequence where he witnesses all of the sin of the world. And in a sequence that is harked back to in a horrifying way in Mother, they lift this animal and then throw it over the side of this wall. And you see it just squealing and squirming. And then everyone just starts ripping it apart. And then he sees all that and is like, nope, no wives here.
No wives here. People are bad. I'm bad. We're all bad. Let's just go extinct. Voluntary extinction movement.
It is in the Bible that Ham departs and that Ham and Noah have this huge falling out. I mean, you've heard of the curse of Ham.
I have.
So I like that this movie gives this weird intrinsic plot detail as to why Ham would be so set on betraying his father in the first place. He finds a woman and then they're running back to the ark and she gets caught in a bear trap. And she's screaming for help, and Noah grabs him and pushes him away and doesn't help the girl, and she gets trampled to death. And it's kind of awesome. Like in a,
might choose another word. Like in it's an awful, entertaining, awesome.
Like in an entertaining movie kind of way. I don't know. I just like the dramatic stakes there. It's not like she's a real, it's not like she really got trampled.
Well, none of this really happened. You know that, right?
I don't. I would never pretend to know that. So Darren Aronofsky is vegan. I don't know if I actually stated that on the podcast. So I guess that makes him feel like he's better than me and gets to talk like this in a movie.
So you eat meat, huh?
I do. But you do, too.
I also eat meat, yeah. Makes us wicked.
Yeah, I've always been wicked.
But I don't know. I've told people this before, that I could see a theoretical future for humanity where eating meat becomes way, way less common and is seen as a moral failing of the past generations. In the same way that we look back on various things that our own ancestors did, slavery and whatnot. I mean, as just terrible moral failings. Why didn't they know? Why didn't they do anything about it?
This movie even goes so far as to visually imply that the forbidden fruit that Eve ate was meat.
Oh, yeah, it does.
It's not like an actual fruit. It's this sort of beating heart that's very fleshy and looks like a muscle.
The original sin.
Would suck to be a woman in this time period. My God.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah. Terrible. It doesn't seem like anyone's doing great.
Oh.
No?
But the women are, well, I would agree with that, but the women in this, as far as the, you know, just people in the crowd, they're being, like, bartered and traded and raped.
You're 100% right. You're right. This is like a post-apocalypse a la The Road, you know?
Yeah.
Just not a great place to be. And everything's covered in ash. Like these desolate, dead landscapes. Beautiful on film. Gotta say that.
You know that I went to the big island in Hawaii and saw all of the new land that was created from their most recent eruption, right?
Jealous of that.
The eruption itself happened in 2018. This is very recent stuff. And I think this movie does a great job of depicting what new Earth looks like. Because that's exactly what it looks like. It looks like volcanic ash.
Cool. Was this filmed in Iceland? It looks like it might have been filmed in Iceland.
Southern Iceland, yes.
I knew it. Yeah, gorgeous, gorgeous country.
Beautiful, beautiful. That mountain, that huge green mountain against the black ash ground is something I could stare at for hours.
Right.
Yeah, Aronofsky is a very strange choice for a director of a movie like this with his The Fountain certainly leans towards something like this, and he does like movies that deal with grander themes of life on a minor scale, But the key words there are minor scale, whereas this movie's telling a huge, huge story, and it's told in a huge, huge way. It's just something we might not see from him again. I don't know if this was a very passion-driven project for him. And I don't know if this is even what he wants to do as like a big budget tentpole blockbuster.
Yeah, you mentioned that he's a strange choice for a film like this. But from what I understand, wasn't he like the main driving force to get this made? Didn't he go to the studio with the idea and everything?
Yes, he actually originally went to them in, I think, 2002, 2003, something like that. And there was already a miniseries being made about Noah's Ark. But I guess at the time it seemed like the concept for that miniseries was too similar to his concept for the film. So they decided to back away, and that it would have been like his third movie. It was very early in his career. And then he returned to this concept after the huge success of Black Swan.
Nice.
I just like the idea of someone who's very religious seeing this movie and deciding to go back and watch all of his other movies.
You know what's strange is that we as like film fans get really obsessed with a filmmaker's work, like an auteur's filmography, but a lot of people don't care about that kind of thing at all.
I know.
They'll go watch Gladiator.
Are you only bringing that up because of that video?
No, legitimately, I do think, you know, they'll be like, oh, Russell Crowe, I should go watch Gladiator. I like Gladiator. It's a good movie. I'd go watch it. Gladiator itself was, you know, back in 2000, hearkening back to the old Hollywood era of these big sword and sandal epics. It was one of the first ones to revisit that genre. But back in the 50s with films like Ben-Hur, which we have an episode on, you should go listen to it, and The Ten Commandments, you know, those are biblical epics. Sword and sandal films are biblical. We don't really have that genre anymore. Hollywood really doesn't make films that have this much money behind them that are also biblical films.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
But this is nothing like those biblical epics, is it?
No, it's definitely trying to make a grander artistic statement, I think, than something that feels like it is trying to tell a safe family story about the Bible.
The tone of this is also grittier, more realistic.
Yes.
Although I wouldn't call this film realistic. Again, it feels like a fantasy film. But it feels like a fantasy film in the same way that Peter Jackson did The Lord of the Rings. Now, those are fantasy films, but there's a really gritty sort of down in the mud feeling to those films as well. Yeah, it feels like this film is referencing that kind of tone. Also feels like the same kind of tone you'd get with, you know, Christopher Nolan's interpretation of Batman, you know, the dark, gritty reimagining.
Yeah.
This is very in vogue is all I'm saying, because as we can also see with Legendary Pictures, Godzilla 2014, everyone's doing this.
It's the post 9/11 aesthetic. Is that what we're saying?
Let's call it that.
I would agree. This movie does feel like it's got that. I mean, everything does, because it's all literally post 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Although the Marvel films are post 9/11, I would not describe them as the post 9/11 aesthetic, though.
I think they are, but that's a whole other discussion.
Oh,
I think they are a major part of the post 9/11 aesthetic. Everyone's just waiting for some other hero to come in and save us. And now we need a group.
No, those are bright and colorful.
I disagree. I think most of them are pretty. Their color grading is pretty dark.
They don't look like the Dark Knight, though. That's a different look.
Well, yeah, because that was achieved organically. It wasn't done through like a cheap post color grading process.
All right.
Like thought went into the imagery of that movie. Are you trying to get me distracted? I feel like.
No, I'm still talking about how we feel about the more realistic biblical epic as opposed to something like Ben-Hur.
I like it. Did I say that? This kind of film is going to grip me and make me more intrigued than something like a sword and sandals epic from the 40s and 50s. And that is a matter of my personal taste as it has developed over time, and also the generation I belong to as a moviegoer. I think that in general, my audience is more interested in something that's a little grittier, a little more violent, and shows the cruelty of the world in a more explicit light. This movie is 2 hours and 18 minutes long, and it really didn't feel like it. It zipped by for me. I couldn't believe it when we were actually at the flood. I was like, I always remember this happening like halfway through, And then I looked up and saw, oh, wow, we are an hour into this movie. That just went on by.
It's true. I did the same exact thing, actually. But yeah, this is not the family-friendly Sunday school version of the story. And as you said, a lot of people will tell you that they didn't like Noah. When I told people I was watching this film, a lot of people were like, what the hell? That's a weird bad movie. Like, that seems to be the general consensus. And if you look on Letterboxd, pretty low ratings. You look on IMDb, pretty low ratings. The general consensus from audiences, and I think critics, pretty split, pretty, people don't really like it. Is it because it's controversial? Is it because it's weird? What do you think?
I think it goes back to what I said earlier about, you know, who is the audience for this movie? I mean, us, clearly, but I would call us niche moviegoers.
Aronofsky fans.
Well, and people who are able to appreciate an aesthetic and goals that are achieved within a film outside of its narrative. And for people who aren't like that and want to be entertained by a big budget tentpole movie, a lot of those people don't want a religious story about how the evils of the earth are coming from us eating meat. And for the more religiously minded people who might show up to a movie like this, they don't want to have this weird combination of evolution with the biblical story and adding in these details from other texts that are considered not a part of the biblical canon in modern society.
Mm-hmm.
So it just is not, it doesn't feel like it's made for anybody. And I think that shows in the reaction to it at large. But I think that Aronofsky's films always find their audience. And I think this one has found me after all these years. Because I was very dismissive of it. I was also dismissive of it because I saw this film with my grandfather very recently after his wife, my grandmother, had passed.
Hmm.
And he really just wanted to go see a movie. He had mentioned Noah, and it was like, okay, I don't want to see like a religious movie. I know it's Aronofsky, but I don't know. And then watching it with him, he actually really enjoyed it. At the end, he said, that was a great movie.
Hmm.
And as much as I do love and respect him, I think that that had something to do with my opinion as well. I was like, wait, was that just like a religious thing? And honestly, most of the effect work, most of the crazy time-lapse stuff in this movie, we've talked about the creation of the world. There's also this really insane sequence where it shows the decade between Noah receiving his vision and creating the ark. And it's following this tiny little trail of water as it's slowly going through the world, coming from the new Garden of Eden that's come from the seed of Eden that Methuselah has provided to Noah. And we're following this tiny trail of water through this crazy time lapse, multiple photos, imagery, and it's gorgeous. And honestly, both of those sequences were not in my brain when I was watching this movie. And then when they happened again, I thought, wait, I saw this on the big screen and wasn't just jaw-dropped, blown away. So I think I might have just been in a bad space when I saw the movie the first time.
But it is true. What you bring to a film is so, so important. What mood you're in. I mean, you need to be in the right headspace for a lot of films. You got to meet them where they expect you to meet them. I guess that's a way to put it. I remember going to see Vice, the Dick Cheney film. But I saw it on Christmas. You know, the day when you're supposed to be just like hanging out and having a good time with your family and whatnot, and to be reminded how much of an asshole Dick Cheney was, how terrible all of that was on Christmas was just a miserable experience at the theater. But it's a good movie.
That movie's explicit connection with the pre-Bush government and the bombing of Cambodia within like the first 10 minutes was like, oh, all right, I know what kind of movie I'm here for now.
Shall we move to final thoughts?
Jeez, I feel like we didn't say anything. Am I making that up? Am I in my head?
We said nothing. No, we said stuff.
I feel insecure about this recording. Do you have any memories of like when your parents told you this story when you were younger?
I remember in Sunday school, they had this little wooden boat that you could fill with little wooden animals. And I always really liked playing around with that.
That's fun. Did you ever have those felt, like, Velcro mat boards?
I don't think so.
Put more felt on the board. Some people will know what I'm talking about.
Right.
We had one of those with the ark and all the different little animals, and they were all, you know, grouped together by twos.
Hmm. in general, I always really liked the Noah's Ark story. It's very epic. Even as a little kid, I had an appreciation for that. The entire world is destroyed in a big flood.
Do you have any suspicions of there being this like humongous flood on the earth that sort of restarted society in a huge way?
No. I prescribe to the theories that these are tales that exist in a lot of cultures because towards the end of the Ice Age, when the climate changed dramatically and glaciers were melting all over the place, there were just these huge floods. And I mean, I believe there's geologic evidence for these massive floods happening as seas were reformed and everything was melting. And the early human societies and civilizations were caught up in them.
Yeah, I have to say, with Aronofsky's environmentalist messages that come through in so many of his films, it is a little shocking that he doesn't even visually really reference the fact that this could be like the origin of the melting ice caps.
Yeah. And there's also not a lot of explicit imagery connecting this to any sort of climate crisis. I mean, this has sort of an environmentalist feel, but it's mainly about just like not eating meat, right? Doesn't feel like there's as much imagery about global warming as I expected. I don't know. Maybe there is. We zoom out and we see the entire Earth covered in hurricanes.
That's true. That would be so scary.
It's a scary story. Noah's Ark is a scary story.
I also thought it was strange that the whole movie, he was like, the water is going to come from the sky. But then the majority of the flood seems to come from the ground. Water's just shooting through the ground.
Yeah, it makes for a very dramatic image of these huge water spouts and tidal waves just engulfing the land instead of the slow accumulation of water. So yeah, it's like this sort of geologic magic flood. So again, it's not as connected to today's climate change. It's not connected to really any climate change. It feels like it's talking about other things.
Yes. Do you think Darren Aronofsky has a wish that the Noah's Ark tale would happen again? Do you think he hates humanity that much?
I'd have to revisit Mother to really delve into that psychology.
That's what I always feel when I watch Mother, is this is just hatred for humanity at large, which is probably why so many people don't like it.
Yeah, but there's good people out there.
I agree. Yeah.
And even he agrees, because it's a very important part in this film that the woman that is it Ham who goes to rescue the woman in the village?
Yes.
You know, he sees that there's good people out there and they died in the flood as well. And that makes him furious. So seems like it's just as much a condemnation of God's choice to destroy the world.
Yeah. Fuck you, God.
And with that, we'll get to final thoughts.
I like this movie a lot. Something I didn't mention in this during the discussion, really. This is the one I've watched twice. I watched this one last night, and then I watched it again today, taking notes and doing the research. I just decided I wanted it on again, for the opening sequence, which I think is phenomenal, and the creation sequence. Both of those just blew me away. Yeah, I really think there's a lot to appreciate about this movie. I think it has a strong artistic sentiment behind it. It looks great. Industrial Light and Magic did an amazing job with these effects. I remember a main criticism at the time was that I thought the Fallen Angels, the Watchers, were very corny. But now I'm like, well, I don't know why I thought that. I think they look amazing, sound amazing, have a great presence. And when they return to heaven at the end, which is a complete fabrication, even from the Book of Enoch, like there is nothing to suggest that God ever took those angels back.
There's no evidence.
Well, evidence on a mythological scale. You know what I mean?
I know, I'm messing with you. I'm sorry.
But it's like, I don't know if anyone ever cares about that. I don't know if anyone even thinks about that. So I just thought that was interesting. I was like, oh, we're taking liberties within the liberties. This is good stuff. Because, yeah, it's, you know, it almost feels like this attempt to re-mythologize this story for a modern audience, which I think is a cool idea.
Mm-hmm.
I like mythology. I do like religion as something that exists. That doesn't mean I like everything about it, not even close. But I don't know. I like these old tales of humanity gone past.
Yeah, the stories that we used to tell and how they've stuck around. I like that kind of stuff, too. We like stories. We like movies.
You got any final thoughts for Noah? Yeah.
It's crazy. It's nuts. It's my kind of blockbuster nowadays because, yeah, so many times when you see these, you know, $160 million films, they're making decisions that are incredibly safe. And I do not blame them for that, because when you're gambling with $160 million, I don't know how anyone does that. I would be petrified. And I don't know. It's very cool to see a blockbuster that is this artistically driven. Even if you don't agree with all of the decisions that are made, and I don't know if I do, but I enjoyed watching it. I thought it was really hammy and entertaining in a lot of ways, which is what you want from a movie that looks like this and is $160 million. But it also made me think about, like, is humanity intrinsically evil? Like, what is wrong with us? What would I do in this situation? And where's my head at? Am I a misanthrope? Do I believe that there's a good future for humanity? How could I think that? Yeah, so it's a good movie. Made me think about a bunch of stuff.
We always find a way, yeah.
I don't know if I'd recommend it to a lot of people, though. I mean, again, who is it made for?
Yeah, if I'm in a discussion where this movie comes up, I think I will... Well, now I know I will jump to its defense because I like it a lot more now. But it's not hard to imagine why anyone wouldn't be into it. Is that it? Any more final thoughts?
Nah, those were my final thoughts. I thought they were pretty good.
I feel like this is a train wreck. I can't wait to hear the episode. Yeah, so thank you so much. Yeah, what do I say next? Thank you so much to all of our regular listeners. Next week, we are going to be covering Bone Tomahawk, directed by S. Craig Zahler. And I probably said that wrong, but whatever. Looks like a cool movie. Neither of us have seen this one, and I want to go in completely blind, so I am.
Hell yeah, it's starring Kurt Russell in a Western. It's also got some fucked up shit.
Yeah, I've heard it's a very violent movie with a lot of cannibalism and stuff in it, so that sounds great to me. And yeah, to our regular listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. If you'd like to hear more A Century in Cinema, more of our random ramblings about the Bible and religion, you should join our Patreon. The link to that is in our show notes and on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page is, of course, A Century in Cinema. We can't believe we only have a handful of episodes left for you, but we are so excited to be so close to the end of this project and really appreciate your loyalty and dedication throughout this whole process. It's been awesome. Thank you, Nathan Royal, for our show's music. And thank you, Arthur, for another wonderful discussion that I'm sure will sound great after it's edited.
And Andrew, thank you so much for a wonderful discussion that already sounded great before it was edited.